KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump says he wants the U.S. to expand into the Middle East. He says the U.S. should own Gaza and the 1.8 million Palestinians who live there should go somewhere else. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. How do federal employees see the administration's bid to get them to quit? I'm Hugh Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We called the union leader who is urging employees to pass on the offer to pursue other opportunities. Also, Layla has the story of a Ukrainian woman serving on the front lines. And why did the National Security Agency's museum cover up plaques celebrating some employees? It's Wednesday, February 5th. This day in 2017, Tom Brady led the Patriots to a giant comeback in the Super Bowl. Sunday, he'll call the Super Bowl in the broadcast booth. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. World leaders are slamming President Trump's plan to take over the Gaza Strip. At a press conference at the White House on Tuesday, Trump said he would like to help rebuild the war-torn region. He also suggested that Palestinians who've been displaced should be relocated. NPR's Jerome Sokolowski reports Trump's comments break with decades of U.S. foreign policy, which has long emphasized a two-state solution.
The Saudi Foreign Ministry issued a statement that doesn't mention Trump's words. But it does say Palestinians will remain steadfast on their land and called the kingdom's position on that unwavering and non-negotiable. Leaders in exile of the Palestinian militant group Hamas did react directly to the comments. Azat al-Rashak, a member of Hamas's Politburo, called them racist. Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri said they were ridiculous and absurd and capable of igniting the region. Here in Israel, government ministers warmly welcomed Trump's words. Others were more circumspect. Former Defense Minister Benny Gantz said they represent creative, original, and interesting thinking. Jerome Sokolowski, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Senate has confirmed Pam Bondi as the nation's next attorney general. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports Bondi secured all Republican votes, plus one Democrat. Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman.
Pam Bondi is a former attorney general for the state of Florida and a Trump loyalist. Republicans view her as highly qualified to lead the Justice Department, while Democrats have concerns about whether she can be independent from Trump. Bondi was one of his personal attorneys during his first impeachment trial in the Senate. She's also echoed his claims that the justice system has been weaponized against conservatives. Bondi now takes the helm at the Justice Department as it is reeling from a series of personnel moves imposed by the Trump administration that have pushed out senior career officials at both the DOJ and the FBI. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump's plan to house roughly 30,000 migrants at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba appears to be moving ahead. NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer reports the first group arrived there this week.
The U.S. has not released an official figure, but it appears to be a small number, possibly just one flight with about a dozen migrants on board. The Department of Homeland Security says they're all members of a Venezuelan organized crime group called Tren de Aragua.
That's NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer reporting. The Trump administration's plan is expected to face a number of legal challenges. Stocks across Asia close mixed today. On Wall Street, Dow futures are trading lower at this hour. This is NPR News in Washington. The United States Postal Service says it will continue to accept all international packages from China and Hong Kong. The agency had previously suspended incoming parcels. The reversal comes a day after the Trump administration imposed 10% tariffs on Chinese imports. Scientists studying images from a lunar orbiter say it took only minutes for two large canyons to form on the surface of the moon. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports the canyons are similar in size to the Grand Canyon in Arizona.
David Kring is with the Lunar and Planetary Institute of the University's Space Research Association. He and some colleagues just used images from a lunar orbiter to study two large canyons that radiate out from a big impact crater. The crater was made when an asteroid or comet hit the moon. This threw up a curtain of debris.
Clusters of rock in that curtain hit the lunar surface in just a staccato series of impacts. Bang, 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 bang.
This excavated a series of smaller craters that line up to form long, deep canyons. In the journal Nature Communications, the researchers say making these canyons took about 10 minutes. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
One of the last surviving Tuskegee Airmen has died at the age of 100. Lieutenant Colonel Harry Stewart Jr. was a combat pilot who fought in World War II. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. President Trump is talking of another territorial acquisition by the United States.
He says he wants the U.S. to take over Gaza, the current home of many Palestinians. Trump brought up the idea during a visit to the White House by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site, level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out.
Turn it into seaside real estate. The president did not rule out the possibility of using U.S. troops while sending the current residents to live somewhere else not yet named. In just over 2 weeks since his inauguration, the president has called for the U.S. to take over a total of four countries or territories: Greenland, Canada, the Panama Canal, and now a war-torn 25-mile strip of land on the Mediterranean.
Joining us now to discuss is NPR international correspondent Aya Batraoui in Dubai. So what's President Trump's vision of Gaza look like?
Well, Trump already signaled clearly many times that he thinks Palestinians should be relocated outside of Gaza. And he says Gaza is now a demolition site, that it's uninhabitable. And this is largely true after nearly 16 months of war and Israeli airstrikes that also killed nearly 50,000 Palestinians, with the UN and Gaza's health officials saying at least 10,000 more bodies are buried under that rubble. Now, rather than live in what he called a hellhole, Trump said yesterday the nearly 2 million Palestinians in Gaza should go elsewhere, other countries.
This can be paid for by neighboring countries of great wealth. It could be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 12. It could be numerous sites, or it could be one large site.
It's really unclear if this is actual policy ideas being formulated or his musings at this point. But Trump, who's, you know, an international real estate developer as well, said he envisions the U.S. taking over this coastal enclave long term and turning it into what he called the Riviera of the Middle East.
We're going to take over that piece. We're going to develop it, create thousands and thousands of jobs, and it'll be something that the entire Middle East can be very proud of.
And Trump has said that it's an idea that everyone he's spoken to loves, but is it something that Palestinians in Gaza would support?
You know, half of those 2 million people in Gaza are children. They need security, stability. They haven't been in school for 2 years now. There isn't even electricity or running water in Gaza. So yeah, some families would leave given this reality. They have said that to us. But also people have lived in Gaza for generations, and leaving would mean the end of any hopes for a Palestinian state. And in Israel, expelling Palestinians from Gaza was an idea that had mostly been relegated to the far right corners of Israeli society. You know, Israel's prime minister didn't comment directly on Trump's idea yesterday, but he praised his, quote, willingness to think outside the box with fresh ideas. And he said this.
After the jaws drop, people scratch their heads and they say, you know, he's right.
All right. So that's one view from the Middle East. But what are other countries in the region saying?
So the major Arab states, they don't want Hamas to rule Gaza, but they also don't see mass displacement as a solution either. And certainly publicly, I don't see how they could get behind this. Now, Egypt has made clear it will not accept the forced expulsion of Palestinians. Egypt has called this an injustice that they won't take part in. And Saudi Arabia, one of the countries of great wealth that the president referred to that would be needed to pay for whatever comes next in Gaza, says it rejects attempts to displace Palestinians. They say their position is non-negotiable and that they've made this clear to the Trump administration.
That's NPR's Aya Batraoui. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, you've made it to Wednesday of this busy week, and the Trump administration is given a deadline of Thursday, tomorrow, for more than 2 million federal workers. They are invited to quit, to go on administrative leave and continue being paid through the end of September. Employees have to consider this amid allegations that the offer is not legal or a scam, to use the word of one Democratic lawmaker. Our colleague Andrea Hsu has some reporting on the NPR app. You can find it there. Reporting that is helpfully clear about the lack of clarity. The administration has spoken in different ways about this proposal at different times. Randy Irwin is not a fan of the offer. He is president of the National Federation of Federal Employees, which represents some U.S. government workers, about 110,000, as a matter of fact. Mr. Irwin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Okay, so this offer, we should note, excludes some federal employees. It excludes the military. It excludes Homeland Security, people who are busy deporting people right now. It excludes National Security. It excludes the Postal Service. So what are the things that people do who are affected? What do these 2 million people do?
Well, what you just described there is about over half the government already. So you're talking about the remaining portion, but the biggest agency by far is the Department of Veterans Affairs, about 400,000 federal workers that care for the American veteran, nurses, doctors, people we represent. We wouldn't be able to make good on the promise we make to our folks in uniform that you're going to be cared for if it wasn't for those folks caring for our veterans. We got land management agencies like the Forest Service, Park Service, Bureau of Land Management. Federal workers care for our federal lands. It's a big job. You know, they guarantee clean air, clean water, safe food, safe air travel, passports, you name it. And people really don't understand how important the services that federal workers provide are to the American way of life.
Okay, so veteran services, land management, park rangers, we may have seen at a national park, EPA, Department of Transportation, consular services for people traveling abroad, a few examples of what the employees affected do. But then there's the question of people being offered what is not really a buyout, but is almost described as if it is. You get paid several months for not working and then you leave. Why advise your people not to take that offer?
Well, let me just be clear. Describing it as a scam is the correct way to describe it. And federal workers should not take that deal. It's a bad deal. They're not really getting anything that they wouldn't be getting otherwise just by the rights that they have. This administration and this proposal has made it sound like you're going to get a buyout and you're not going to have to work until September 30th. But the truth is there is no guarantee of that. Congress has not authorized it, and it is more than likely that folks are going to get stiffed on that.
Wait, you're saying people might quit at the end of February and think they're going to be paid for months, but actually they might say, actually, we're laying you off as of March 1st. That's what you think will happen?
No, I think they're just not going to let them quit. Because the way that they have written the contract, it's not a guarantee that you won't have to work.
Oh, you're put on leave and you might be called back.
Right. There's no guarantee that you won't have to work.
Okay.
So what kind of deal is that if you're going to have to work to that resignation date anyway?
There is a threat now hanging over people that if enough people do not take the buyout, there will be reductions in force, layoffs, people will be fired. Is that a real risk for federal employees?
I think it's an exaggerated risk. I think that this administration is overplaying its hand. I think that they let people know ahead of time that they wanted to see a reduction in the federal workforce. But the kind of things that they have said, they wanted some 75% reduction in the federal workforce, cutting $2 trillion from the federal budget. That's what DOGE has been saying, mm-hmm. what their
Elon
goals
Musk,
are.
Right.
Those things are absolutely irresponsible, impossible types of things. If they did, we would have nothing. Our federal government would be unrecognizable, and the critical services that the American people rely on would be gone, like the care of American veterans. We make a promise to people, and if we lost 75% of the VA workforce, we could not follow through on that promise.
This administration is advancing an idea of presidential power, that there is one executive, one elected official in the executive branch. The allegation is made that they're fairly hostile to the federal workforce, but their allegation is the federal workforce is hostile to us. They argue that the job of federal employees is to obey the president and not push back. He's elected, you're not. Do your members broadly accept that general framework as they go about their jobs under any administration?
That's a complicated question. Let's talk about federal employees being hostile. I mean, that is a ridiculous notion. It is only Donald Trump and his folks that have had that view. Both Republicans and Democrats in the White House haven't always necessarily been friends to federal workforce, but have always had respect for the incredible work that federal workers do.
Do they follow whatever the president says to do, and should they?
No, they should follow the law and uphold the Constitution. They swear enough to uphold the Constitution. That's what federal employees are there to do.
Randy Irwin is national president of the National Federation of Federal Employees. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
At least 11 people are dead and many wounded in the worst mass shooting in Sweden's history. Terry Schultz reports a motive for the gunman's attack on an adult education facility is still not known.
Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson spoke to the country in a late evening press conference, visibly shaken by the tragedy that had unfolded just after midday in Örebro, about 2 hours west of the capital, Stockholm.
It is difficult to grasp the magnitude of what has happened today, the darkness that is now settling over Sweden tonight.
Teachers and students describe running for their lives when the gunshots rang out and seeing others who didn't make it. Some students at the school reportedly stayed on the scene for at least a couple of hours before being evacuated by police, who told them to close their eyes as they walked out. Although this Nordic country has one of the highest rates of gun violence in the European Union, school shootings are rare, and the unprecedented number of victims has shocked Swedes. Here's Justice Minister Gunnar Strömmer.
It's something you read about with horror, happening in other countries, but we think that doesn't happen in Sweden.
Strömmer said the gunman was among the casualties, but beyond this, authorities had little information initially about the man's possible motive and why he targeted the Risbergska school, which teaches adults studying for high school diplomas. Swedish media say he was a 35-year-old local resident who had a license for a hunting rifle. Police raided the suspect's home and said for now they believe he acted alone, had no terrorist motive, and was not part of gang violence that's racked Sweden in recent years. Other schools in the city will remain open Wednesday as authorities seek to maintain as much normalcy as possible.
Men vi kommer finnas ute.
We will be out there, Örebro Police Chief Robert Edforest told reporters. We will show up and try to create as much security as we can. But the police chief said he understands there's a lot of fear in this community right now. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Örebro, Sweden.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, one of Pete Hegseth's first actions as defense secretary was to declare the end of the DEI era. A serious problem the military is facing, though, is a severe shortage of recruits. We'll talk about why, how the military is attempting to reverse the trend, and how vulnerable to attack we've become with Dexter Filkins of The New Yorker. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. On the day I'm supposed to speak to Lara Marlowe and the Ukrainian soldier she profiles in her new book, Lieutenant Yulia Mikitenko can't make the interview.
She says, I must warn you that a great possibility that I won't be able to join this time. We have a massive assault all over the front line, and I need to be online and on the phone.
Marlowe is used to it. She spent months chronicling 29-year-old Yulia's life in a first-person account of what it's like to be a Ukrainian woman leading a unit fighting Russian forces in her homeland. Sometimes Yulia would have to miss meetings to pick up dead bodies of her comrades, inform their families of the deaths, or do drone reconnaissance of a battle. Her life on the front lines is the story Marlowe tells in How Good It Is I Have No Fear of Dying.
I wanted to write about women in the Ukrainian army because I had read that there were 60,000 of them, of whom about 10,000 are in combat positions. They put me in touch with several women, but the one who really, really impressed me was Yulia Mikitenko. I started by putting my foot in and I said, are you the lady drone operator? And she said, I am the commander of a platoon, of a reconnaissance platoon. I said, oh, sorry. And so gradually, over about an hour, her whole life story came out, how she had joined the army to be with Ilya Serban, how he was killed in a Russian bombardment, how she stayed in the army. Her father self-immolated on the Maidan in 2020 because he thought that Zelensky was capitulating to Russia. So she's known a terrible tragedy, and yet she seemed very calm, just a really lovely person.
I think people often forget that the full-scale invasion in 2022 was not the beginning of this war, that Russia annexed Crimea in 2014, that Yulia fought before,
yes,
and her husband was killed, as you write in the book, in 2018, and her father made that protest before the full-scale invasion.
Yes.
You open the book, she's gotten out of the military, and she's kind of trying to figure out what to do with her life. And the full-scale invasion begins, and she goes right to that recruitment center. And I thought it was so telling the way people kind of dismissed her, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's getting a gun, everybody's getting recruited, and she just sleeps there until she joins the territorial defense. If you could just tell us about her military career, the challenges she's faced as a woman, and the way she led the way for other women to join the front lines in Ukraine.
Well, she joined in 2016. Initially, she was assigned to admin work. She was a secretary and accountant, and she was furious. And so she started complaining, saying, I am a loyal citizen of Ukraine. I joined the army as a volunteer. I should stand guard duty like every man. And eventually, one morning, her name was on the roster for guard duty. And that was a small triumph for her. She was 21 years old then. And then she found out that since she had a university degree, she could become a commissioned officer. And her commanding officer said, would you like to head this reconnaissance unit? And she said, yes. And when she became the lieutenant in charge of the reconnaissance unit, 16 out of 20 men in the unit transferred out. They did not want to be under a woman's orders. And she was devastated. But She kept her unit running with just four men, but several of them did return to the unit because word went round that she was actually a very good commander.
You know, I was thinking about this too as I read her experience, because it starts with the first booms of the full-scale invasion beginning. And in 2025, I'm reading it at a time when U.S. support for this war is in question.
Mm-hmm.
How does Yulia feel about the incoming administration, and other Ukrainian soldiers feel about the incoming administration, what this might mean mm-hmm. for Ukraine's war?
She's obviously very, very interested. And they've been talking about it certainly since November. They had become very disillusioned with the Biden administration because she had told me it was like Groundhog's Day. Nothing ever changed. Mm. But I think that they probably trust Trump a little bit more than I would. They really have very high hopes in him that he will not betray them.
Can I ask why they have this trust? I mean, because a lot of the president's supporters really wanted the U.S. to stop spending any money on Ukraine and this war and to get out of it. Mm. So what makes them hope?
I think if you're under fire day after day, if you're getting shelled and somebody says, I'm going to put an end to this, I think you want to believe them.
You know, it was interesting reading your book in this moment in the U.S. when, you know, women's role in the military is being questioned. The Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, in the past said women shouldn't serve in combat roles in the U.S. military. He's since walked that back and said as long as they meet standards. What does Yulia's story say about women in combat?
I read Pete Hegseth's quote to her. And she laughed and she said, that's exactly like the post-Soviet generals in Ukraine. Because, you know, the older military brass would have served in the Soviet army. And there's a bit of tension between the young officers like Yulia and the old fogies.
You call the book How Good It Is, I Have No Fear of Dying. Where did this come from, this title?
It's the first line of a very famous poem in Ukraine, which was written by a dissident poet called Vasil Stus. And he died in a Soviet labor camp in 1985. But for me, it really embodies what the book is about, because Yulia's husband, Ilya, was not afraid to die. He died for his country. Her father was not afraid to die. And in his way, he died for his country. Yulia is not afraid to die. She really does not have any fear of dying.
Wow.
And it's emblematic of the whole country, of everyone in Ukraine who is resisting Russian aggression, who is saying no to occupation, who's saying we will fight for our independence.
Laura Marlow is the author of How Good It Is, I Have No Fear of Dying. Lieutenant Yulia Mikitenko's Fight for Ukraine. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Leila.
This is NPR News.
Irish poet Padraig Ó Tuama spends a lot of time thinking about other people's poetry. In a new anthology, he brings us 44 poems about the pleasure and pain of relationships.
I was curious about how it is that poetry could speak to all kinds of experiences of the human condition.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, poet Padraig Ó Tuama, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and Turkey are among the countries criticizing President Trump's idea that the U.S. take over Gaza and redevelop it. Trump spoke about it yesterday while standing alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at a White House news conference. Democratic lawmakers in Congress are denouncing President Trump's efforts to slash federal spending through the entity DOGE. NPR's Elena Moore reports.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says Democrats are sounding the alarm.
Whatever DOGE is doing, it's not democracy. We know what democracy's like. It's out in the open. It's not secret.
Democratic senators like Chris Murphy are speaking out.
I worry that the American public is not going to rise up against the seizure of power if they see Democrats collaborating with Republicans on the floor of the Senate on a regular basis to pass legislation or support nominees.
Murphy says if Democrats can raise public sentiment, it could move some Republican lawmakers to oppose Trump-backed nominees or legislation. But that has yet to happen. Elena Moore, NPR News.
The Senate has confirmed President Trump's nominee to serve as Attorney General. The vote was 54-46 to confirm Pam Bondi, the former Attorney General of Florida. This is NPR News from Washington. President Trump's nominees to lead the Department of Health and Human Services and to be Director of National Intelligence have advanced out of Senate committees. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard await confirmation votes by the full Senate. President Trump's executive order halting federal funding of certain gender-affirming treatments is being challenged in court. As Mariana Bacayao reports from Nashville, some families say they've been denied care since the president issued that order.
Kristen Chapman left Tennessee after the state legislature banned gender-affirming care for kids like her daughter Willow, who is transgender. But she didn't get the care they moved for in their new state of Virginia either. Willow's appointment came the day after Trump signed an executive order banning treatments like hormone therapy and puberty blockers for anyone under the age of 19. The ACLU is suing on behalf of her and several other families. The ACLU is also representing a Tennessee family in a U.S. Supreme Court case that could determine the future of transgender health care nationwide. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacayao in Nashville.
Private employers in the U.S. added 183,000 jobs last month, more than what was seen in December. That's according to payroll processor ADP. On Wall Street, stocks are mixed. The Dow is up 3 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. In President Trump's first 2 weeks in office, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents have arrested more than 8,000 people. It's part of Trump's promise to deport violent immigrants who are in the country without legal status. However, NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran reports the raids are also picking up people without a criminal record.
There's this video that Juan watches over and over. In it, his son Carlos wears a black hoodie, green cargo joggers, and white slides. In this video taken just over a week ago, he's doing a wheelie on his new shiny blue bicycle.
Ren rey, al niño con el juguete nuevo. Ándale.
You can hear Juan cheering on Carlos. Juan says his 18-year-old son was so happy that day, January 25th. Carlos had just bought that bicycle with money he had saved from his job at a nearby pizza shop. He came from Venezuela to the U.S. legally in November using the CBP One mobile app for his entry appointment. His immigration hearing was scheduled for July 2027. But the day after buying the bicycle, everything changed, says Marian, Carlos' stepmother. Marian says a handful of vehicles belonging to federal immigration officers surrounded her home in her quiet neighborhood in Cedar Park, Texas, just north of Austin. Marian opened the door when agents wearing ICE and DEA uniforms knocked. They asked for Carlos, she says. So she called Carlos to come out of his room. He was immediately arrested. Marian says Carlos started tearing up when he was put in handcuffs. One of the immigration agents told him to take off his watch because he was not going to need it anymore. She says immigration officers told her Carlos had appeared in a video with firearms and drugs, but they didn't show her any video. Carlos doesn't have any gang tattoos, she says. He's never been arrested and does not represent a danger to society. We are withholding the full names of Carlos and his family because they worry speaking out will impact Carlos's case. NPR could not corroborate the existence of such a video in social media and could not find any criminal record for Carlos in Texas, the only U.S. state he's lived in. ICE didn't respond to multiple requests for comment about Carlos's arrest. Rahawala is a lawyer with the National Immigration Law Center.
It's increasingly obvious that what was intended to be a targeted campaign is an indiscriminate program of fear within our communities to pick people up regardless of their immigration or citizenship status and irrespective of whether they've been involved in any crimes.
In the first 2 weeks of Trump's second term, ICE posted on social media how many people they had arrested. The day Carlos was detained, about 1,100 people were picked up by ICE across the country. But it's unclear how many didn't have a criminal record. ICE didn't respond to requests for a breakdown of who's been arrested and for what crimes. In a briefing last week, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt was asked how many people arrested had a criminal record.
All of them, because they illegally broke our nation's laws and therefore they are criminals, as far as this administration goes.
But again, Carlos came into the U.S. through a legal pathway. He is currently detained at an ICE detention facility in Taylor, Texas. His parents say he has not been charged with any crime. It's unclear whether he'll eventually be deported to Venezuela or released. Juan and Marian, his parents, say this is tearing their family apart.
Él es un muchacho joven que apenas está empezando.
Juan says Carlos is a young man who is just opening his eyes to the world.
Lo único que le pido al presidente Trump, de verdad que tome, se apiade.
He asks Trump for mercy and to take pity for the immigrants who came in the legal way, like his son Carlos. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Cedar Park, Texas.
The National Cryptologic Museum papered over some history. The Cryptologic Museum, it celebrates the nation's code makers and code breakers from the National Security Agency, which is right next to the museum. And that museum taped sheets of paper over plaques that celebrate women and people of color. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports on what happened next.
News that the museum had covered up the exhibits broke online, angering many NSA retirees. Even after the museum uncovered the plaques, dozens of retirees showed up there Monday just to make sure, and they were mad.
Didn't somebody say, oh my God, that's wrong? Why didn't that happen?
This is Helen Adams. Her late husband, Ralph, was executive director of the NSA, which intercepts foreign conversations and breaks government codes. Ralph Adams was also black. His face was not among those obscured. Still, his wife was incensed and questioned NSA public relations staff.
That says we don't want to see black or brown faces. You're going to cover them up like they don't exist?
No.
NSA retiree Rob Johnson was equally appalled.
I worked in this agency for over 51 years. As much as this administration eschews truth and honesty, it is important that we not allow it to erase history.
In a phone call, NSA Executive Director Sheila Thomas, the number three person in the agency, told NPR that covering up the exhibits was a mistake.
There was absolutely never an intention to cover up parts of our history.
Thomas said NSA leadership didn't provide enough guidance to staff as they tried to implement President Trump's order, terminating diversity, equity, and inclusion in the federal government.
We were not clear and really responsive to potentially any questions that may have been arising, because people were they were on rapid fire trying to move very quickly and be responsive.
And why was it such a rush?
Well, as you know, we're getting a lot of executive orders. There's a flood the zone's a fair phrase there. And we are being as responsive as we possibly can. Some of these have short deadlines.
The former NSA workers are glad the museum restored the exhibits, but they're still unsettled by what happened. Larry Pfeiffer spent 20 years at the agency and served as chief of staff at the CIA. He thinks someone covered up the honorees because they were afraid what would happen to them if they didn't. Pfeiffer says it's a sign of the climate of fear right now in Washington.
We have appointees to this administration who have said that they intend to traumatize the federal employee workforce. We have seen people put on administrative leave with the threat that they're going to be fired.
Pfeiffer posted a photo of the papered over exhibits that helped galvanize his fellow former NSA workers. He says there's a lesson in all of this.
There may be small bites at the apple here that we can all take to push back against this attack on the federal workforce. You don't have to try to take it all on. Maybe you focus on what you're an expert in.
As for Thomas, she requested some grace as her agency works through rapid requests from the new administration. And she encouraged people to come see the museum. Frank Langford, NPR News, Fort Meade, Maryland.
This is NPR News.
For Black History Month, we're looking at artists who helped shape popular music. In the 1980s, Prince was key to bringing R&B and funk to the masses. Next time, here and now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep with news from Scotland. The government says it has no plans to ban cats. The Scottish Animal Welfare Commission reported felines kill 700 million birds and other animals each year in the UK and recommended containment, such as limiting adoptions, which led to howls of protest or meows of protest until the government said they won't be banning cats at all. Doesn't matter. As everyone knows, cats go exactly where they want anyway. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. UCLA has one of college basketball's greatest legacies going back to the 1960s and 70s. Its men's program once won 7 straight NCAA championships and 88 games in a row. This year, the UCLA women's team is carrying on that legacy as they're the only unbeaten Division I college basketball team left. Steve Futterman reports from Los Angeles.
UCLA's Pauley Pavilion has been the home court for many of college basketball's greatest teams. This year, another Bruin squad may be joining that long litany.
And now, get on your feet, clap your hands, and raise your voices for the starting lineup of your UCLA Bruins.
UCLA's women's basketball team has been perfect so far this season. 21 games, 21 victories. The latest on Sunday, a 26-point win over Minnesota. The Gophers coach Dom Plitzuwhite was impressed.
What are they good at? They score around the rim. They don't let you score at the rim. They shoot it well from the arc. They don't let you shoot it well from the arc. So just about every aspect of the game of basketball, they are dominating in.
UCLA's rise to the top has not been sudden. The Lady Bruins have won 27 games in each of the last 2 seasons. The team is led by 6'7 center Lauren Betts, who says she's playing with a new confidence.
I think I'm just playing like a lot lighter, and I feel like a lot more free when I'm playing.
Is that a difference from, a little bit difference from last year?
Yeah, I think last year I was so worried about like the wrong things, and I think it had a lot to do with things that weren't really in my control.
Whatever she has done, it's working. Betts is averaging 20 points and almost 10 rebounds a game. There are a number of connections to the historic UCLA men's program. The most visible on this year's team is guard Gabriela Jaquez. She is the sister of former UCLA All-American Jaime Jaquez Jr., who now plays for the Miami Heat.
I don't know about royal family, but super grateful that I'm a Bruin. Super glad that I got to share 1 year with my brother here. We both got to play.
And there are many strong ties to legendary coach John Wooden, who won 10 titles at UCLA, the most in men's basketball history.
I met him in 1993, the fall of 1993. I was a nervous wreck.
Bruins coach Corey Close first met Wooden when he was in his 80s and she was in her 20s. She calls him a mentor.
If you were to ask our players, they would all say, oh, we hear Coach Woodenisms every day.
What are some of your favorite ones?
Well, I think failure to prepare is preparing to fail. Make each day your masterpiece.
Watching all this from afar this season is an early pioneer of women's basketball, Ann Myers. She led UCLA to its only women's basketball championship in 1978. She refers to Wooden as Papa and says he would be proud of this team.
It's chemistry. You have to have chemistry, and a lot of times, no matter how good or talented certain players are, it's a team game. And whether, you know, UCLA, when they had Coach Wooden here, and you had Bill Walton or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you had other pieces, and you say, oh, this guy is so great, this guy is so great. He said, yeah, they're the engine, but you have to have a steering wheel. You have to have 4 tires.
Another double-digit victory for the UCLA bunch. Unbelievable.
Tonight, UCLA has one of its toughest tests, facing off against number 8, Ohio State. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Be quick, but don't hurry. This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Trump signed an executive order to reimpose maximum pressure on Iran. He told reporters he was, quote, torn about signing this, said he hopefully won't have to use it much. Trump's return to the White House comes after Iran suffered a series of setbacks, which are giving many anti-government activists in Iran hope. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports.
It has been a tough few months for Iran's hardline regime. Israel heavily degraded two important proxies, Hezbollah and Hamas. It also assassinated senior Iranian military officials and pounded Iran's air defenses. Then came the fall of Syria's regime under President Bashar al-Assad.
The Islamic Republic has lost one of its biggest allies in the region, one that it's propped up for more than a decade.
Holly Dagras is an Iran specialist at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and closely charts social media in the Persian nation.
This has really been dire for the Islamic Republic's foreign policy in the region.
She says there's been a distinct mood change among people posting on social media since Assad's surprisingly quick fall from power.
They suddenly see this collapse of a regime that the Islamic Republic had propped up. It kind of gave them the sense that there is this possibility, there is this chance that this could also happen at home, that this regime could be toppled.
This wave of optimism amongst opponents has not escaped Iran's leadership. Iran's 85-year-old supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, recently warned against protests. And tens of thousands of heavily armed paramilitary fighters paraded through Tehran, in part to send a signal to any homegrown dissent. There have already been ongoing protests for months over the economy, corruption, and the like. That's helped spark a new wave of crackdowns in the wake of Assad's fall from power, says one 38-year-old activist living in Tehran. She asks that we not use her name because she fears retribution from the government.
Whenever Iran's regime is defeated, they just get more merciless and violent with activists inside the country. They have started a new wave of crackdowns and arresting social activists.
Mojtaba is a 37-year-old former political prisoner who asked that we not use his last name for fear of government reprisal. He says the security crackdowns have made it hard to coordinate larger protests.
There's no organized opposition inside, despite the fact that a majority of the population in the country are protesters and against this regime.
What's fueling hope this time is President Trump returning to the White House. During his first term, Trump pulled the U.S. out of Iran's nuclear accord and imposed tough sanctions in a bid to weaken the government. Nima, a 44-year-old who also asked that we not use his full name out of fear of the regime, says President Joe Biden took a different approach and was too soft on Iran.
Biden's administration weakened a lot of the sanctions. That allowed Iran to sell its oil and give the regime more freedom and flexibility.
Nima hopes Trump will enforce the sanctions more stringently, leading to the collapse of the regime.
Mr. Trump has made it clear that he is not pursuing regime change in Iran directly, but there's no doubt that he's going to weaken the current Iranian regime to a great extent, using economic sanctions.
Trump has indicated he will get tough with Iran, but has also left the door open to diplomacy. The Washington Institute's Dagras says this will be a consequential few years for Iran.
Not just because there's a Trump administration, but also because the economy's in shambles. Their resistance axis has crumbled. There's a historically high anti-regime sentiment. And presumably, there will be a supreme leader transition at some point.
All of which could spark regime change in Iran or force the government to crack down harder on dissent. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Polar bears spend their days jumping from ice into water. So if they get all wet, why doesn't their fur freeze? NPR science correspondent Jonathan Lambert reports on a new study in the journal Science Advances.
Nanophysicist Bodil Holst got interested in studying polar bear fur while watching a German quiz show.
In that quiz show, I learned that polar bears are invisible in infrared cameras.
That essentially means that they're so well insulated that their fur takes on the temperature of their frigid surroundings. That's the case on land and when they jump into icy water to hunt.
because I had been working with anti-icing, I just suddenly was very puzzled because I was thinking, well, how do they manage that? When they get into the water, they go out again. Why do they not get covered in ice?
Meaning they stay cold, but their fur is largely free of ice. Holst, who's at the University of Bergen in Norway, initially thought that the structure of the fur itself might have some kind of de-icing properties. So her team used a high-powered microscope and zoomed in on some fur.
But we couldn't see anything special about the polar bear hairs. They just looked normal.
But as she and her colleagues were handling the fur, they noticed that it was really greasy. And when they washed the fur with soap, wet it, and froze it, it got icy.
And so we realized that this was down to polar bear hair grease, effectively.
Molecular analysis of the hair grease revealed that it was chock full of certain compounds which are resistant to ice. And the fur lacked a compound called squalene, which is found in other marine mammals. Squalene, it turns out, has properties that make ice stick to it.
We can say that this is what makes polar bear hair grease so efficient.
In fact, the team found that the squalene-free fur grease performed about as well as certain kinds of PFAS chemicals that have been used in ski waxes. Finally, to bring it all together, one of Holst's students took it one step further.
Didn't wash his hair for quite some time, and then shaved and made a little mat of his own greasy hair and tried to test the anti-icing properties and could see very clearly that human hair, whether you wash it or not, is not very good at anti-icing.
Holst hopes that her research could eventually lead to things like greener ski waxes, lubricants, and even new de-icing fluid for airplanes, all inspired by greasy polar bear fur. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Okay, it's kind of mind-blowing, eh? I mean, you start with this curiosity, you know. I mean, I've been outside in the cold and my hair has frozen. So why doesn't that happen to polar bears? And you follow that question and end up de-icing airplanes. That's just wild. That's really something.
That would be impossible for me now, Steve, because I don't have as much hair as I once did. I used to have a thriving civilization of hair on my head. It is now ruins like Machu Picchu.
Got you. You can't perform the experiment.
No, I cannot.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.